Lee, what were you thinking? My name's Joe Krogan. I'm an alcoholic. And it's always a privilege to do anything when you're asked for Alcoholics Anonymous. This is truly an honor to be here in the light. And I can't screw this weekend up, thank God. It's been tremendous. Thank you to the speakers we had this weekend. First person I want to thank is my wife. Thank you for always being there. My partner and my support. And my kids, wherever they're at. There are two kids running around here. But and Lee and John for being friends. And for asking me to do this, I think. Nobody wants my job this morning, I know that. But the speakers this weekend, thank you all very much. And I first attended this conference, I think, in 1991 when it was in Daytona. And I came here 2 weeks after I got out of a treatment center. My sponsor brought me, and of course he paid. And I heard the speakers almost over the years, the same speakers we've heard tonight. And I don't know, I won't speak for you, but I'll speak for me. They become like sponsors in my life. And I would go to my sponsor at moments when my world was collapsing, when I was full of self-pity, when I didn't think I was going to make it, or I thought, what's the use? And I would go to my sponsor, and he would always have the most sage advice that I ever got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think that's why we come here and we listen to these speakers. This is what I feel when I listen to the men that have talked and the women that have talked at this conference this weekend. My sponsor would look at me and he would say, it's going to be all right. I know you're going to walk away feeling that way after this weekend. It's going to be all right. These always make me emotional. This is I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you would help me, I'd like to start before we get into this. I can't wait to hear what God's going to say today. But I like to take a second moment of silence. One of my sponsees taught me this. He said, if you want God to be real in your life, you have to treat him like he's real. So I like to take a moment and invite the God of my understanding, and you're welcome to do with that moment what you want. Usually I pray for the speaker. So if you would indulge me for a moment. Thank you. Okay, I put the tie on and the jacket on, and now they're coming off. I am not an expert on Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am a satisfied customer. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. God, what a weekend this has been. Just been incredible. I've been asked to talk on the 12th step. My God. Everything's been covered. I thought today, I said, what can I say after all these speakers? What a remarkable weekend. And I came up with it. Ditto. Thank you all for coming. See you next year. Safe travel. Anyway, my home group, my sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. I'm homeless right now. My wife and I have just moved. My old home group was the Take It Easy men's group in Lady Lake, Florida, or the Villages. And, excuse me, I have just a touch of the swine flu. Wait, don't go. Those of you that haven't already gone, you missed it by that much. You were seconds from a clean getaway. My home group is, and for those of you that don't know, the Villages is like the world's oldest, largest retirement community. And it's amazing. The name we got, Take It Easy Men's Group, is because one of the guys that named it had an early onset of Alzheimer's, and he couldn't remember the slogan was Easy Does It. True story. And he called it Take It Easy. I thought that's one of our slogans. And it stuck. But it's a remarkable group. It's about 70 guys that meet every Friday night, and A lot of them are here. They've been very influential in my life. My sponsor was one of the founders of that group. And there's guys that come from all over the country with all kinds of sobriety. 50 years, it's nothing to have 40 years or 30 years of sobriety in this group. You got to have 20 years just to make coffee in this group. I tell you my sobriety date is September 12th. I really don't remember a lot about that. I don't remember a lot about September 12th. I remember an awful lot about September 11th. I'm going to share a little bit about what had happened to me on September 11th. I woke up that day in a Skid Row motel room in Fort Lauderdale with a little boy that was 2 years old and his mother, my son. And I didn't know it was going to be the last day I ever took a drink, because as a matter of fact, that's not what happened to me. It's not my story. I woke up that morning and I cracked my eyelids open, and that fear, that terrible, terrible feeling, oh my God, I'm not dead. And I don't know if there's anybody in here can relate to that, but I know. I used to wish, please let this binge be the one I don't wake up from. I don't want to wake up from this one. I don't want to have to sober up. See, I discovered that I had an epiphany that day. I discovered that alcohol and drugs were not my problem. They were my answer. Actually, my problem was lack of alcohol and drugs. I think if there was enough, I would have never made it here, because I did not want to sober up. That was one of those days when you crack your eyelids open, and some of you know what that feels like, when you open your eyes and you're not dead and there's nothing left. There's no booze. There's no drugs. There's no money. There's no one left in your life. There's just this wreckage that you've got around you. And I couldn't lie to myself one more day. Jerry talked about hitting bottoms, and I think we all have to hit a bottom. I didn't know this was my bottom. To date, this was my bottom, and I didn't know. It talks in our big book about Bill W. when he hit his bottom, and I read that, and it really hit home with me. And he talks about when he was in the hospital for the last time, and the doctor told his wife that they would have to turn him over either to the Undertaker or to an asylum. And he said, I knew that and welcomed it. I remember that feeling. I remember that. What happened to me that night on September 11th was I had that feeling that, so this is how it ends. I was to go on to join the endless procession of sots that had gone on before me. I know what the meaning of that sentence is. I thought, so this is how I die. I'd never read that sentence, but my words were a little different. So this is how it ends. This is how I die, either in the street, in the gutter like a drunk, or in jail. I thought about it, and I thought, I couldn't, you know, hitting bottom, I heard hitting bottom described as this. When bad things start happening faster than you can lower your standards. And that was happening to me. I couldn't lower my standards any lower. I think the day before I had an epiphany. I thought my problem was lack of discipline. And I said, maybe I should join the Army. They don't have a lot of use for 39-year-old alcoholic drug addicts. So that idea didn't seem to work. But that night in that motel room, I looked at my little boy. He was 2 years old. He was in absolute filth. The place was in filth. It was a Skid Row motel room. He had a little bottle that was watered down milk. My story's a little different than a lot of people. I know it talks about in the book, there are those of us that outside of their drinking were normal in every way. That's not my story. I remember thinking, and I've heard all different descriptions here, and I used to, when I first came in, and for those new people that are here, we're so glad you're with us. And I remember when I was new, I used to try and figure out, did I drink myself into being an alcoholic, or was I born an alcoholic? And I have a buddy of mine, he says, what came first, the chicken or the keg? And I pondered that for a long time, and it didn't seem to really. Eventually, I got to the conclusion. My sponsor told me, and I think it's on page 23 in the big book, and it says we finally arrived at the answer to this. And the answer is, there's no answer. What a break! Thank God I could stop trying to make this thing work, figure it out. And that's what happened to me on that last day. I surrendered. I said, that's it. I can't buy into my lie one more day. I can't get up in the morning like I'd done 6 months previously and get up in the morning and go, that's it. Today, I'm done. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to take a drink. I swear to God. And I'd look at my little boy and I'd cry and I'd say, I'm going to be a dad today. I'm going to go out and I'm going to get some groceries in the refrigerator. I'm going to go out and get a job and I'm going to turn my life around. I swear to God. And I meant it from the bottom of my heart. I would even go out and get a newspaper. I would scrape together some pennies and I would get a newspaper. I'm going to look for a job. But between the time I woke up and I made that promise and the time I got the newspaper, my brain started working. And I'd be looking in the newspaper and I would start going, ah, what the heck, all the good jobs are taken. You know, tomorrow I'm going to get up real early. I swear to God, all I need is a couple beers just to calm me down. And tomorrow I'm going to turn my life around. And you know, as bad as things were, I would take a couple drinks, or I'd take a hit of something, or snort something, or do something. And the first thing I would think was, what the heck was I worried about? Things aren't that bad. See, alcohol was always my solution. And it really never stopped working. I told you, my problem was lack of it. So that day I resigned. I said, I'm done trying to quit. That was my 9/11. I said, that's it. I'm done trying to quit. I've surrendered to this disease. I surrendered to dying. I didn't just surrender to recovery. Now, does that sound like the last day you're ever going to drink and drug? How did that happen? It was. There was a knock on the door that night. I remember that night I had this, what I call my reverse spiritual awakening. It was a moment of clarity. I saw myself. I sat there and saw my life the way it must have looked from other people's eyes. With no excuses, no rationalization left. I couldn't lie to myself one more time. Absolute collapse. This is what I think hitting bottom for me was. I'd lost the faith in the only power I'd ever known in my life. The only thing I'd ever listened to my whole life. My brain. I couldn't buy into it one more time. I remember sitting there thinking, if I was two people, I would kick my own butt. You ever had that feeling? I was so angry at me. And I hated what I'd become so much. The problem with self-loathing is by the time you get there, everybody else hates you too. So there's not a lot of places you can go. And I was trapped in this life and I couldn't get out of it. That night I saw myself as I really was. And a strange thing happened, as we hear so many times when Bill introduced Don. He really choked me up. What a great story, but that's how this thing works. Every one of you in this room has had a miracle. You may not be able to articulate it as well as some of the speakers have, but I know every one of you have had a miracle in your life. There was a knock on the door in this motel room. Now, at this stage of your drinking, you do not open doors, and you do not answer telephones. I got tape on the peephole. You know, I don't want light escaping. There's a knock on the door, and it was my brother. And he came in there, and he looked at me, and he looked at the surroundings, and he saw the filth and the squalor, and I could see the horror in his face. And he just put his phone number down on a piece of paper, and he said, you need help. He said, if you want help, I'll look after your son while you get some help. And that was September 11th, and that was the last day I ever took a drink or a drug. And now how he found me, I don't know. I hadn't seen him in 2 years. At that time, I owed everybody money. I thought that's what he wanted. My motto was, if I know you, I owe you. So I'm not looking for anybody. And the next day, there was something when he said that you need help. There was like a light went off. Now, I did not know of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never met anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. The words left my lips one time in my entire life. My son's mother threatened to leave me in that motel room one time. And you know the bitter loneliness that only an alcoholic, it talks about it in A Vision for You. I remember the day she threatened to leave and I blurted these words out of my mouth. I don't know where they came from. I said, I'll go to AA. And I'm like, where the heck did that come from? Luckily, that passed. Because I wouldn't have known where to find you or anything about you. And it did pass. But I had heard of treatment. So I resigned to go to a treatment center because I thought that's what I needed, was some treatment. I'm going to go to treatment. I'm going to get some pills. And somebody's going to tell me something. They're going to educate me. and my life's going to change. So I ended up going to a treatment center for indigence in Miami for 6 months. But let me go back to the beginning a little bit and tell you a little bit about how I got there to that point. And I never started out like this. I was born in Niagara Falls. All I did was I liked to drink. I liked to drink. I liked to party. From the first time I did it, I loved it. It was, you know, it talks about why I drank on page 83. You will know a new happiness and a new freedom. You will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. You will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle you. I read those promises. I go, that is exactly why I drank. Every one of them. They came true in my life. It truly was a spiritual awakening. Everything seemed to fit together. I go, so that's what I am. And my whole life, it's like I would come to people and I never knew what I was. And I would love when people would go, you know what's wrong with you? Please tell me. Because I can't figure it out. I know there's something, but I haven't got a clue what it is. And if you would have told me it was fear, I would have thought you were crazy. But I was afraid of everything and everybody. There's another reason I drank. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave you. $20, I was loaded when I was drinking. I never worried about tomorrow. All those things came true when I drank. And I seemed to just party my 20s away and my 30s away. I remember I had some feeble attempts at getting sober. I owned a bar on South Beach for a while in my 30s. It was one of those times when I said, all right, I'm going to straighten my life. I was always straightening my life out. I'm going to straighten my life out. That's it. And I'm going to turn my life around. I opened up a bar on South Beach when it was just getting going. This was my Don Johnson period, as I fondly remember it. And I remember one time they threw me in the drunk tank on a Sunday morning there, and I was in my white linen jacket and my pink shirt, and I'm stepping over the bodies in the drunk tank. It's in Miami Beach, no air conditioning, and some drunk wakes up, and he looks up. He said, what'd they arrest you for, being overdressed? So it was just another escapade, but that bar kind of catapulted my alcoholism, and I really started drinking. I started having some problems with the drinking at that point. I was getting close to my mid-30s, and I started having some physical problems. My organs weren't functioning the way they were supposed to, and you know the things that are happening to you. And so I thought about something. I said, how can I stop drinking? I got to just stop this drinking. So I did a little experiment. I tried a little controlled crack smoking. See if it would keep me out of the bars. It did for a short time, but I drank a lot more. And finally, I got to a point where it was so bad that I had resurrendered again, and I said, that's it. I think this was the only time I remember saying to myself, that's it, I'm done. I can't take this anymore. Remember that theme song? We all sing it about 2 hours before we got here. I can't go on like this. I need help. I started singing that. You know, I have had a lot of spiritual awakenings. They just never stuck. I remember another great spiritual awakening I had 4 o'clock in the morning in my underwear in the back of a cop car. That's a good time to have a moment of clarity, too. I'll never do this again, I swear to God. But they didn't stick. This was one of those times, and I said to myself, that's it, I'm done. And what happened was, I really meant it. But my grandmother died and left me an inheritance. And, you know, I always wanted that one more binge. I just need the one more binge. Just get it out of my system, and then I'm going to settle down and really get serious about this thing. You know, just to get that one. Because the last one I had, I came close, but I didn't quite get there. You know how it is? We just couldn't recapture that thing we were trying to get that we first had, those promises. What happened was is I went on a binge to end all binges. That's where I met my son's mother, and we went on this tear. And life spiraled down for us, went through that money, and it was a large sum of money, and went through that money in a short time, and the health issues were really starting to creep up. And what happened was she got pregnant, and I had stepped over every single moral I'd ever thought I had in my life, and she got pregnant, and I thought my idea of a stand-up guy at that time was, I'll pay for an abortion. That was my idea of a stand-up guy. So I gave her some money for an abortion, and what happened was is she didn't get it. She told me she did, but she didn't. And what happened was is a few months later, we were out of money, and we were going to have a baby. So now what do we do? I said, okay, I've always, crazy as it sounds, I've always wanted to be a father. That's it. I'm going to turn my life around. We got to get out of Miami. This place is evil. It's killing me. Let's go someplace totally different. We packed up, moved to West Palm Beach. And got to West Palm. I said, now I got to get a job. I'm 35, 36 years old, and I got to get a real job. I've never had a real job in my life. You know, I heard some of these guys talk. I heard Jerry talk, and he talked about getting his law degree, and he went to law school. And when I was new, I couldn't understand. How could you do that? If you were like me, you had to drink. But I remember periods. I used to be a bartender, and I remember I finally realized I can't drink when I'm behind the bar, because the moment I take a drink, I have to get on that side of the bar. And I don't even care about the job anymore. I'm on that side of the bar. The boss would come out. What are you doing? Who needed that job? Because the alcohol would always take me. And so we moved to West Palm, and I got to get a real job now, and I'm looking in the newspaper. What do I do? I've got no experience. I've never worked a real job. I look in the newspaper, and I see perfect job for me. It says, no experience necessary. I said, perfect. I'm qualified for that. So I go down, and back then, this was the mid-'80s. They used to send you for a polygraph, and they would do a urine test on you to see if you did drugs, and they would run a credit app, and they did all this on for me, and I came back for my second interview, and the boss says, is looking at the reports, he said, oh my God, you lie, you do drugs, and you owe everybody in the world money, you're perfect, when can you start? And I started selling cars that day. Now, I don't know why, but I took to it. It was a job I really liked, and maybe some of my previous dishonesty had qualified me for this position. But the boss saw something in me and he used to say, kid, I'm going to make you my star. He was the same age as me, but that's how we talked, you know. And he would take me aside, and he said, I'm going to make you my... You see these guys? There were 18 salesmen. They're all going to hate you. Oh, big deal. I already think they do. And so at the end of the month, we had a sales meeting, and they hand out the commission checks, and I'm sitting in the room, and he said, all right, Joe Krogan, come on up, and he gave me a commission check, and it was $7,500. My first legitimate job in my life, $7,500. I said, oh, my God. And then I said, what was I worried about? This isn't all that hard. Then he calls me up, and he says, and salesman of the month, and he hit everybody. I sold like 24 Hyundais, so if you've ever bought a Hyundai that you think has a lifetime warranty, see me after the meeting. I owe you an amends. But he calls me up and he gives me another check for $4,500. So now I'll do the math. 12 grand. $12,000 first month on a real job. Best job ever had in my life. What do? I go, I got to go show a car. I'll be back after lunch. 16 days later. Now here's the crazy part. It's not that I missed work for 16 days. That, and don't moan, because I know you've done stuff like this. Yeah. What's crazy is on the day 16, I got up and put a shirt and tie on and went to work. Like nothing happened. And they yelled at me for wanting to say, now get out there and sell a car. I said, I love this job. For a while, I made enough money to keep the wolves away from the door. I was making a little bit more, and my son was going to be born. So I tried to reestablish some credit. I bought a little house, and I remember going to the house. I bought a car. You know, I was like a real person. And I say that to my kids now. I'm like a real dad, aren't I? You know? And I remember when my son was born, I went to the hospital, and oh my God, something happens. I don't know if it happens to everybody, but it happened to me. It was like a light switch got thrown. I looked in that little boy's, I picked him up and held, and I cried, and I, you know, God, I love you. And I, you know, I instantly fallen in love. I don't think there'd ever been a person in my entire life that I've ever fallen in love for. I don't know if you can relate to this. There's something inside of you that you know if there was a shark in the water and he was in the water, you would instinctively jump in. I'd never felt that way. I'm a coward. I'd never felt that way, but I knew there was another human being alive that I loved in a different way. I was changed. And I walked out of that hotel, and I said, that hospital, I said, I am going to be the dad you always want. I'm going to coach you in Little League. I'm going to be there. We're going to hug each other, tell each other we love each other, even when we're grown men. We've got a relationship that I've always wanted to have. I'm going to be there for you. I'm going to give you the love that you've always wanted, that I always wanted. And I walked out of that hospital room, and I didn't come back home for 8 days. I could not not drink. I take one drink to celebrate my son's birth, and I was in. The phenomenon of craving would kick in and I would be gone. My life got a little worse again. I couldn't keep the wolves at the door forever. You know how it is. And eventually we snuck out of that house as they foreclosed on it and moved back to... That's when I ended up in Fort Lauderdale in that motel room. And things got real ugly now. And I have to share this with you because it's astounding how God can work, how God can turn things around in people's lives. We're in that motel room, and my son's mother told me she was pregnant again. And at this time, we're really beyond help. I remember when we first got to Fort Lauderdale, I found a guy who hadn't seen me. It took about a year and a half for this to happen. He hadn't seen me. He knew my reputation as a salesman, and he said, come on, I'll give you a brand new car to drive, and I'll give you a job. And went down, got the car, and I said, I can't start today. For the next 8 days, I was calling in sick to a job I'd never been to. and they had to come and tow their car away because I wouldn't open the door. Remember, I told you, at this point, we don't open doors. There's nobody good on the other side of that door. Bill W. said there was quicksand stretched out around me in all directions. It was there. And so my girlfriend's pregnant again. I said, that's it. And this was one of the lowest things in my life. And this wasn't even on my first fourth step. You want to talk about how deluded we are? Because I don't think I could handle it. I said, that's it. We're going to give this child up for adoption. I don't want to bring another child into this. Look where I'm at. Look where we're at. We were both helpless alcoholics. That's not the real reason. There was zero virtue in me giving that child up for adoption. The reason I gave that child up for adoption is because the adoptive parents supported the mother. And I was, by this time, just a hanger-on in this motel room. I'd become lower than low. And my child was living in squalor and filth. I should have been, people are put in prison for what I do. And eventually I told you the story. I gave up my right to live on September 11th. I said, that's it. All I want to do is drink till I die. I'm going to be a full-time alcoholic. And I don't know why, but I was like a puppy in the middle of the road. I was plucked from the bag by the scarf of the neck and dragged out of harm's way. I don't know why, but I was. And I ended up in that treatment center in Miami, and my life turned around from that moment. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and they brought in a meeting. And that first time they brought in a meeting, I remember the guy brought it in, and he had pants with creases, and he had a watch. I remember thinking, God, if I could get my hands on that watch, I wouldn't be here. I stayed in that treatment center, and he looked around, and he said a couple things. So if you're new, maybe you'll understand. He said something like this. He said, you never have to drink or drug again if you don't want to. And if you're new, I thought to myself, I said, well, that's nice. I really wish that, but that's probably not going to happen. It's only a matter of time before I screw up. The only reason I stayed in this treatment center, it was a six-month treatment center. I was looking for the 30-day job with the weight room and the Olympic pool. They don't give those to indigents, right? I remember them asking me when my brother dropped me off. They told me, they gave me the test and the interview, and they said, gave me the 20 questions. Have you ever lied about your alcohol or your drug use? Yeah. Have you ever affected your work and your relationships? I'm checking yes. I'm going, this is depressing. Because he told me 6 months. I go, I'm not like those people. This is, you know, I saw some of them. And finally, I get a question I didn't have to answer yes to, and it was, has alcohol or drugs ever affected your menstrual cycle? And I said, no. So maybe I got a chance here. He didn't think it was funny. So he said, go out back and I want you to start raking lines in the dirt. There'll be somebody out there to show you what to do. They didn't give us too hard of tasks. And I was raking lines in the dirt and I was crying and bellyaching. I said, you know who I am. I used to have Joey's on the Ocean. My name was in lights on Collins Avenue. And the guy says, quit bellyaching. I used to be the district attorney for the state of Rhode Island. And I said, oh, one of my peers. And but, you know, I don't know why I stayed, but I stayed. Well, I do know why. Those of you that had legal problems before know what this term is, ROR. Do you know what that means? Release on your own recognizance. The biggest thing that I didn't want to happen was they release me on my own recognizance. I had finally known who the enemy was. He was me. Please don't let me go back out there and have to make decisions in my life. I will screw up. I will screw up again. I know I will pick up a drink. I'm thoroughly convinced that I will drink again. And that's the only reason I stayed. I got out of that treatment center and I went to the only place my parents had bought a little mobile home in the Villages or Lady Lake, Florida. And they were watching my son and helping take care of his mother. And I got out of that treatment center 6 months later. And I went up to Lady Lake, Florida, and I was sitting there that first night there, and there was a guy, old guy, because that's all there were. I mean, this was the elephant burial ground, watering his lawn right next door to my parents. He's watering his lawn, and he says, hey, kid, I hear you had some trouble with alcohol and drugs. And I said, oh, Mom's been talking? And he said, would you like to go to an AA meeting tonight? Sure. And he says, I'll pick you up at 7:15. And I look out the window, 7:15. There's his little white car outside. And by the way, when I say old, he's as old as I am now. That looked old then. And he was outside. The car was idling. I'm going to tell you, this is a word we used to use around Alcoholics Anonymous when I first came in 1990. I don't hear it very much anymore. And this was the description. And he let the car idle, never beeped the horn. I went out, got in a car with him, drove to the meeting, smoked his cigarettes, burned up his gas, and told him my tales of woe. He dropped me back off. And the next day, I'm having dinner. And all of a sudden, I look up from the table, and there's that little white car outside, idling. Never beeped the horn. Now, I'm going to outwait this old guy. He's not going to outwait me. I said, I thought we just were going to a meeting, not going steady. And he just waited. And eventually I went out there. And you know what that word is? It's called unconditional love. That's what Frank did. That's what we got from our speakers. We get that. It's going to be all right. Frank took me to meetings for 6 months. I never missed a meeting. Frank put me on the circuit. We're going here, we're going here, we're going here. You're going to do this. You're going to make coffee here. I made more coffee than Starbucks. And I never missed a meeting till I got my own car. But Frank started to take me through the steps. I remember 3 days after I got in Lady Lake, I had now listen to how God works in this in our lives in here. And I know He's worked like this in your life. Even if you can't see it right now, you will. I went to go apply for a job. There was a Cadillac dealership in town. I go down and apply for a job, and the general manager's going to see me. And eventually, I get in to see him, and who do you think it is? It's the same guy that gave me that $12,000 check 4 years earlier in West Palm Beach, Florida. And I'm asking, well, I've been in a treatment center. I go to meetings, and I need a job. And he says, well, we can't let you sell Cadillacs, but we got this little dealership out back. You can go to work out there, a little Mazda dealership. And I did, and I started to work there, and I started to go to meetings, and Frank started to work with me and take me through these steps. And Frank, you know, I didn't realize these steps are all designed to set you free from you. That's really what they are. They're to take you from self-reliance to God-reliance, and they're idiot-proofed. My program is the program. You never see the books, you know, Foreign Languages for Idiots. I should have the book AA for Idiots. It's idiot-proofed. Frank started taking me through these steps, and I remember we started talking about, he said, step one, I'm going to make it easy for you, kid. Frank was a retired postman, and I thought, what am I going to learn from a guy that gets a pension? You know, that's how I thought. And what's this guy know? He's been married 50 years. What does he know? I need the guy who's been married about 6 or 7 times. That's who I want for advice. Right? Those are the people I'm looking for. And I got a room full of them. So Frank would tell me, he says, I'm going to make the first three steps real easy for you, kid. He said, step one, you're screwed. That's it. End of story. You're screwed. He said, step two, it's going to take a friggin' miracle. And step three is, what the heck, try it. Now, I could understand that. Because I was screwed, and he knew I was screwed. I couldn't go back. Otherwise, I wouldn't be riding to meetings with a guy who's a postman. So Frank started to work through steps. And Frank, early on, started to say, I started with that step two and with the God thing. And I said, you know, what about this God thing? And, you know, if there's a God, listen, I learned early on, I was willing to believe there was a God, but I just knew he liked other people better than me. And I didn't know how resentful that made me. But it did. And Frank said, listen, I said, what if you don't believe in God? He said, it's not, you know what? You don't have to believe in God. All you need to do is start living like you believe in God. I said, I can do that. He says, you're right. You've been a phony your whole life. We can do that. We started doing things like that. I remember I went to work and I was working in this little dealership. And you know, things get put in your way. Mildred said it, that teach you. And I remember the boss and that was the manager of this little Mazda dealership. He was a guy that I knew in West Palm, and he was still active. I didn't think he was an alcoholic. It's not for me. I judge no man, as Scott Redmond used to say. But I remember we became chummy, and he says, come on, let's go out one night. And I wanted to go out just to listen to the music, okay? And I ended up about 50 miles from home in Orlando, in places I shouldn't be with this guy, and he was absolutely bombed out of his head. And I'm very early on, and I'm starting to get panicky. And I don't know, I mean, I'm really getting panicky. I'm having like an anxiety attack. We got into a big fight. I have to go now. You don't understand. I have to go now. And I ended up taking a taxi 50 miles to get home. Well, the next day, you know how we are after we get drunk and we show our behinds? He might have been a little embarrassed, but you can't admit it. It had to be my fault. So I get a page to the office the next day I go to work. And he says, Joe Krogan, come to the office. And he's in the office, and he says, I know you go to those AA meetings, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, I want you to tell me the truth. Do you talk about me there? Now, I didn't at the time, but I do now. But I knew I was screwed. This job was not like, you don't understand, I need this job. I haven't filed income tax in 20 years. I got felonies out there. I've got a child that I need to support. I need this job. I call Frank. I run back to my office. Frank, oh my God. This goes, Frank, this is a Frank says, this is a perfect opportunity. Frank's big deal was, I want to get you to rely on God, not on you. And he said, I want you to pray about it and let me know how God works it out. If I could have come up with another idea, I would have done it, but I couldn't. And so I did what he said. The next day I show up for work, true story, the next day I show up for work, Tony's nowhere to be found. He had got shot 8 times the night before trying to buy some drug. Now, he wasn't hurt. It was a very small caliber gun. He was released from the hospital the same day. True story, but he was shot 8 times. Company car shot up. They towed the car in. I saw the car on the rack, but he was gone. Disappeared, gone. I go back to the office and said, Frank, you won't believe it. God shot the guy 8 times. And so I knew there was something to this program, you know. I knew there was something going on here that I wanted. But Frank took me to my first roundups. Frank took me through my steps. I did a step like Bob talked about the first one, but I'll tell you what, I needed to do that step. I needed to get rid of that stuff. Keith Lewis used to say, you got to talk about it. You got to talk about the goat and the midget. Sorry. And he was right. But I needed to tell another man. I did things with Frank that set me free. First relationship in my life that I ever went to, and I know this, you probably have never done this, I lied to Frank. When I got my own car, I remember coming over to Daytona one weekend. I said, I'm going to Daytona. Frank says, great. I used to live there. Go to this meeting, and it's a great meeting. Sure, I'll be glad to, Frank. I get back, and of course he asked me, how was the meeting? Oh, it was great. Really spiritual. And I couldn't sleep that night. That's never happened to me. I was a great liar. You don't understand. That was my mechanism. And I go to Frank the next day, hardest thing ever done in my life. Only time in my life I can ever remember doing it. And I went to another person and said, I lied. I never remember doing that, ever. 40 years old. I said, I didn't go to that meeting. I found out, Frank taught me how to tell the truth, how to not be afraid, how to overcome that fear. And Frank just looked at me and he said, with all the love in the world, like a father would look at his son, he goes, God, you're full of crap. And I loved Frank, and I knew he meant it, and I knew he still loved me. We went through the rest of the steps, and Frank was big on service. He would always, you know, I'm going to eventually get to step 12, I know, because I believe in this thing. I believe that. I started to have some problems. Things came up. The IRS resurfaced. You know how they will once in a while. I hadn't filed income tax in 20 years. Frank, and by this time, Frank would go sponsor this guy, and he finally got me a guy to sponsor. I was looking for, like, district attorneys or pilots like Sandy. You know, but here I get a guy, Ralph. This guy, Ralph. Go sponsor Ralph. And Ralph was drunk. And Ralph wasn't even sure he wanted to ride. Ralph was living with his mother, just like me, in a trailer at the time when I met him. His eyes were bloodshot. He stunk of cigarettes and booze. And I would have to. And by this time, I got my own car. It's not a new car, but it's new to me. And I'm taking Ralph to meetings. And every time something would go wrong, Frank, the IRS just seized my bank account. First savings account I ever had in my life. I never had a savings account. And the IRS seized it. Frank would go, oh, isn't God good? I said, what do you mean by that? He said, you would have never wrote the check. Now we get to get rid of that. We get to face that monster. It's gone. And we walked through these things. He walked with me through all these things. But he would always say, now call Ralph and go take Ralph to a meeting. Ralph doesn't even want to go to a meeting. And so I remember taking Ralph. And one day, Ralph, I remember the meeting. We get to the meeting, and Ralph stinks like booze. And I'm steaming all the way to the meeting going, that's it. I'm telling Frank. And there was, Frank isn't going to listen. So there was another old guy who's got 33 years at the meeting. He's since passed away, Tom O. And I said, I'm going to tell Tom. He was like the patriarch in the area. I'm going to tell Tom. Tom's going to deal with this guy. Get him out of here. He doesn't want to be here. And we get to the meeting, and Ralph throws up in the front seat of my car. Now I'm walking 15 steps ahead. The steam is coming out of my ears. I'm reporting this guy to the AA hierarchy, and we're getting rid of him. I bring him into the meeting, and I'm sitting there looking at him. He sits down next to Tom O, and I'm staring at him across the room the whole time. And Tom, I go, oh, I think he smells it. I think he smells the booze. Oh, we're getting ready for some sparks now. And Tom leans over and hugs Ralph as hard as he can. And he says, I love you. Keep coming back. What I know will kill me. Frank taught me what I pray for will kill me. He helped set me free. You guys have helped set me free. Frank was big on sponsorship, and I didn't do it. I met my first wife. She was working at Intergroup with my sponsor, Frank, and Frank would come home and tell me tales of Tammy and I am now my beautiful, lovely wife, Tammy, here, and she is gorgeous. And but we met. We had both come through a terrible, terrible marriage when we met, and it was to each other. So for those of you that don't understand, she is my second and third wife. Okay. So we had a lot in common when we met the second time. We could complain about our previous spouses. Wasn't he a jerk? Yeah, he really was. But we met in AA. We fell in love, and I didn't have a lot of time. 3 years sober, 2.5 years sober. She had a little bit more time than me, and we ended up falling in love. And she had kids, and I had kids, and we, you know, it was AA. It was perfect out of the 12, AA boy and girl meet on AA campus. And by this time, things are happening in my life, and I can't figure it out. But I'm getting back all these things. You know, I remember that statement in the Big Book. It says, spiritual well-being always precedes material well-being. And I'm getting spiritual and checking my wallet. Nope, not spiritual enough. Let me keep going. Oh, I'm going to get so spiritual. The IRS is gone. The felonies are gone. I got a great job. Things are starting to come my way. And I think it's the rewards of sobriety. And I'm very busy at my life. I got a beautiful wife. I've got a life back. We got our kid. I got custody of my son. I'm raising my son, and then together we raised him. And we get a great job opportunity. Now this is when this is how far. It doesn't happen overnight, but I tell the guys when I go into the prison, I go, you know, you guys, the rate of coming back is incredibly high. I said, what happens is when you get out there, you start running your life again till you run it in the gutter. Jail seems like a step up. That's why you come back. When we run our life again, jail's a step up. You're in a better place than where you were the day before you got here. So what happens is I'm taking charge of my life and I'm running my life. And I got all the way to step 11 and I dabbled in step 12, but I kind of started, Frank used to say, you unwork the steps one step at a time. And I started unworking those steps, started taking back. I started listening to me again. I got a job opportunity in West Palm Beach, Florida. We moved to, that's it. We're moving to West Palm. I'm going to run some big car dealership. The best job, I can't believe it. 5 years earlier, they wouldn't let me on their property. And I've got this job with hundreds of people working for me and very big money. And my wife says, I don't think that's a good idea. I said, we're going with or without you. That came back to haunt me. I ended up coercing them into moving, and we ended up moving down there. And I took this job, and I got very busy. And I got busy, and I kept saying, I'm going to catch back up on my meetings as soon as I get this job, this career opportunity up on its feet. And I'm making more money I ever made in my life. We bought a big house, and I'd come home, and my wife would be on my back, and my kids wouldn't be disobedient, and I would like, what is going on? And nobody respected me. And you don't know how hard I'm working. You know, look what I've done for you. And within 6 months, boy, we come apart fast, don't we? The guys go back out, they come apart fast. I'm one of those guys. 6 months, our situation at home is absolutely intolerable. She can't stand it anymore. And she said, you have to leave. I want a divorce. And I'm back on the street with my little boy. And I'm absolutely enraged. And I got so much anger and I don't know what to do. And I take my son and we're out there, and now I'm spinning out of control and I'm mad at God, I'm mad at everybody else. And what happened was I started racking up debts and I started doing stuff I shouldn't have been doing. And the next thing you know, I'm in debt up to here, worse than when I got here. I'm applying for credit cards to pay off credit cards, and I got my little boy with me, and I'm absolutely destitute. And now they fire me from my job. I went from being the hero to being the zero. So now I'm out of a job, I'm in debt, and I'm so angry. And here's my program of recovery. Every time I want to go to a meeting, I got to look at a pamphlet, a where and when, to find a meeting. That's a good program of recovery. So I've got no program. And I remember I was so angry, and I knew to drink would kill you, but I didn't care. I was so angry with God at this point, I said, I don't care. If that's sobriety, you can have it. I remember going by this bar, and I always, on the way home one night, and I thought, God, that's an attractive place. I would love to drink in that place. And, you know, and I circled that bar. It's hard to drink when you got 5.5 years sobriety, and you know to drink will die. And I would drive by that bar every night for 2 weeks like a vulture circling its prey. And it had a name that was very attractive to me. I remember the name said Bar. And that's what it said. And the parking lot was in the back. Now, those of you who know how to drink, you know that's really important stuff. Because you can park there, nobody knows how long your car's been there, day or night, and I can go into this place and be a big shot. I know I can start running things. Finally, I have my little boy asleep, and I just can't take it anymore. I woke up in a rage against God. And I go down, I said, I'm going, and I drive across town to this bar, and I am going to drink, and I swear to God I'm going to drink. I don't care. And I'm at a traffic light a block away from the bar, and I got butterflies in my stomach. You know, it's scary what I'm about to do, and I don't even know why I got these butterflies. And I look over, and there's a broken-down van here with its hood up. And on the front license plate it said, have you prayed today? And I used to hear Frank say, what the heck, try it. Because this is a try-it-and-see program. And I remember I said the Serenity Prayer. Crazy as it sounds, I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous instead of that bar. I went into a sober blackout. I don't even know how I got there. Walked into a meeting, walked in the back door of the meeting, and a meeting I'd been to one time before, a year earlier, and there was 150 people there at this meeting, and I'm in the back, and there's a guy at a podium, and he says, tonight's anniversary night. We're celebrating anniversaries. We have about 6 or 7 celebrants. Is there anyone else here having an anniversary in the month of September? I said, oh, my God. Me. It's my anniversary. 6 years sober. And I was my 6-year anniversary. And he said, this is what we do. We all come up here and share for about 10 minutes on how we stayed sober. You're our visitor. You start us off. Even back then, I got the worst job, right? So he calls me up, and I get up, walking up front. I'm going, oh, my God, this is going to be good. And I turn around, and I look out at everybody, and I can't speak. And all I did was start crying. I said, I need help. I don't know how to do this thing anymore. I need your help. And I'm bawling. And there's a row full of people from the treatment center, newcomers. So they go, that's not how it is at 6 years. And they sweep me off the stage. Thank you. And then two guys grab me and take me back into the kitchen, right? And like the old joke, they go, we're going to show you one more time. And I became that guy where they put their arms around me and they just loved me again. And that's when something happened. It started to click. Step 12 became important in my life because Frank had always pushed me to service. Frank's big thing was get out of self. It just didn't mean anything. It's like, remember when you were new? I used to look at those 12 steps on the wall, and I wanted step 12. Okay, I don't care about the rest. I want the spiritual orgasm step. Let me get to that step. That's what I want. I want to feel good. That's it. I want it. And it didn't happen that way. Frank used to tell, this is one of the things Frank set me free. I remember we were driving to a meeting one night. Frank would always be talking to the new guys after the meeting. He'd be in a corner, and I'd be sitting there by the car waiting. Come on, Frank. I'm your date. And he'd always be talking to some guy, real loser, like me. And Frank was talking to a new guy, and I remember one day I finally asked him after a couple months. I said, Frank, you know, you're not like me. You're a really nice guy. I'm not. When is this AA thing going to start to work on me? When am I going to feel like a nice guy? When am I going to feel like helping people? Because I really don't. He said, Joe, if you wait till you feel like helping someone, you'll die. You just do it. Frank told me this program is nothing but manual labor. For me, I don't know what your program, but for me, it's manual labor. It's doing the deal. And I discovered that after that period in my life. I had guys that took me to the jails and took me to the detoxes. And Bill and I were talking about a guy. I remember I couldn't go back to the car business. I had the first time in my life I ever made a decision based on spiritual principles. I had my little boy, and I said, you know what? I'm going to stop being somebody I'm not. I'm going to be who I am, and I'll start with what I got. I'm going to be a dad. My son was about 6 years old. And I said, I'm going to get a job. I don't care if I have to get a job at 7-Eleven. I'm going to get a job where I can take him to school and I can pick him up and I can do his homework with him. And he taught me how to be a dad. And I remember we took a little job. It was in an office job. A friend of mine called me out of the blue and said, you want a job? I've got a job for you over in Port Charlotte. And I went over there and started doing that job, started taking my son to school and back, and I started going to the jails and the detoxes, and God put this guy in my life. He's since passed away, and we love him. I can see Bill crying. He saved my life. I remember hearing him share at a meeting. I thought, man, this guy is out there. He is spinning out of control. So he came up after the meeting and said, listen, I know you're new here, but I really like what you said. Would you mind sponsoring me? And I said, sure. And I thought, this guy's really... I always get these winners. I said, how long have you been sober? He goes, 5 years. I said, 5 years? I thought you had like 5 days. But Ernie Ernie made me take him through the steps. And I got to go through the steps with Ernie. And that's when my life started to change. And Ernie dragged me around to these jails and these detoxes. And then I finally did what Ernie did. I went to a guy and I said, would you take me through the steps? And he took me through the steps again. And my life started to change again. And, you know, I realized for me, and I don't know about anybody else, I realized those first 11 steps are like half of a circle. It's great, but Don said it today. It won't keep you sober 6 months or 6 minutes, he said. And that's the truth. Step 12 is the other half of the circle. Until I take this thing, take somebody else through the steps, until I give this thing away, I don't get to keep it. You know, I've heard Bob say that. You can't keep it unless you give it away. I don't think you can get it unless you give it away. And I agree with that. That's what happened to me. I didn't get it. I've had such magical moments with guys, taking them through the steps, on our knees. I've been in prisons with 45 guys on their knees, all of us taking the third step prayer together. I've been in the chapel with guys in prison where I got to take the fifth step with them, and you're both bawling like babies. And you see their lives change. Incredible things happen. I'll read you a promise they don't like to read. And it's the 12-step promise. And it says, life will take on new meaning. To watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. You will not want to miss it. That's the promises that happen at step 12. I discovered things when I remember guys coming back to me, Joe, I got my license back. Oh my God, Joe, I got my kids back. I got a job. And all of a sudden, I started to realize something happened one time with one of the guys I was working with. He got the miracle, but I got the blessing. I walked away feeling like the miracle happened to me. Even though he got the miracle, I got the blessing. I went, wow, that's how this thing works. You know, Bill W. said something in our literature. He said, you know, first we do this thing because we must to live. Then we do this thing because we know it's right. Eventually, we do this thing because we love it. This is where the good drugs are. This is where the high is. This is where the buzz is in step 12. And I didn't know it. And the only way I found it is through the pain of being out there and trying it again and banging my head again. I started to do these things, and I started to work with other guys, and my life took on a new meaning. And I love it now. I love it. Last night, I was worried sick. I'm thinking, oh, my God. And I got one of my sponsees here. He says, he's been bugging me. Please, can we do my fifth step now? Can we do my fifth step? And you know what it says in the fifth step. You were prepared for a long talk. Last night, it was like 10:30 at night. I've got some serious worrying to do about tomorrow morning. You want me to do a fifth step with you? Are you nuts? And I got to go sit in his room till like 12:30 at night. Thank God. Thank God he shows up in time. And I didn't have to go through all that mental anguish. I ended up throwing myself into this program of recovery again like I'd never done before. And isn't it amazing that God hides the answer to all of our problems where a selfish, self-centered, self-absorbed person like me will never look? The answer to all my problems is in helping you solve yours. Don said his mantra today, and I love Don immensely. He's been a huge part of my recovery. Mine is what it says on the top of page 20. It says, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend on our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Now, I don't live up to it, but it's my prayer. But it's my prayer. That's what I pray for. Because that's the hardest thing in the world for me to do. I remember the first time I read it, I go, are you kidding me? They don't really mean that. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. But what you get is so much more out of it. My wife and I remet. She had done the same thing I had done through the pain of that terrible marriage we'd gone through with those terrible people the first time. We had both thrown ourselves into our program of recovery and met like new. I truly was reborn. This is where you draw close to God. You know, that step 12 is where it says in the bottom of We Agnostics, it says, as you draw near to him, he will disclose himself to you. This is where you get to see God in others. All that stuff. We're sure he wants it, our head in the clouds and our feet on the ground. This is it. Let me tell you, when I'm sitting in a prison for that hour and a half, you hear it in meetings, right? You always hear people, new guys always say this, how do I know what God's will is? I'm going to tell you what, when you're sitting in a prison for an hour and a half, you are sure you're in God's will. I don't know about the rest of the day, but I'm sure I'm in God's will. When I'm sitting there doing a fifth step with somebody, or working somebody through the steps, taking them through the book, I'm sure I'm in God's will. So I just look for those moments, those bright spots that keep me going, that kick me to the next bright spot. My wife and I ended up meeting. We ended up getting together again. And the next thing you know, we've got two little boys. They were running around here. My son, they're over there. My son, Maddie, he was at Daytona last year. And after the meeting, after the weekend, he goes, Dad, has everybody in an AA been in jail? Not your dad. We ended up having two beautiful children, and we ended up coming together. It's not been easy. We've had our ups and downs. I faced a bankruptcy, because the other part of step 12 is when you read in step 12, it talks about we have to take these practice these principles in all our affairs. And I didn't know, Don talked about it, Don B. And he said, what about my marriage? What about my business? And it talks about making our business and earning money as a way of giving service. And I do that today. I run my business as a way of getting service. And there's a guy who works with me today. I'm not a boss. I'm a coach. I coach my people through the steps, through the principles, even in my work. We practice these principles in all our affairs. My prayer when I get up in the morning is, how can I be a service? How can I help meet their needs? And I try and preach to them. And we're salespeople. Don't sell. Don't sell. Help them. The money will come. I'm not worried about the money. And it's always seemed to work out for us. I remember we ended up growing a little faster, and I went through a terrible time of economic insecurity. And I remember waking up. I couldn't sleep in the middle of the night, and woke up one night, every night for 2 weeks, and I would read the big book, and I would pray, and I would read some other non-conference material. And I would pray, and finally, after about 2 weeks, I had an epiphany, and I said, you know what? Everything that's really of value in my life, I can't lose. I can't lose God. I can't lose my wife, my kids. I can lose my house, but I can't lose my home, because I can make a home anywhere. I can't lose Alcoholics Anonymous. You people will take me. You've taken me at the high and at the low, and you will continue to do so. I thank you for showing me the way, and I'm going to just, I know we're kind of running late, so I'm going to close with a quick story. There was a bar that I used to love to go to in Miami, and it kind of sums up the change and the transformation we talked about this weekend. I love this bar. It was open, didn't open until 5 o'clock in the morning, and when I owned my bar, I'd go there with my little entourage, and you couldn't get into this place unless you were known. It had no sign. You had to ring a doorbell, and they'd slide the little door open, and they look out, and if they knew you, you would get in. And you'd walk into this place, and there'd be limos double parked everywhere, 350 people in this place, not a window in the place, and you'd be there drinking all night long. If people got stabbed, they would throw out the guy who got stabbed. They would never throw out the stabber, only the stabby. Don't bring us down. Anybody? And I love this place, but here's why I really loved it. You'd go there on a Saturday night, get there about 5:30 in the morning. Well, Sunday morning, they're going to kick you out, right? 10 o'clock, 10:30, 11 o'clock in the morning, they open that door, and on Miami Beach, the sunlight is brilliant. Oh, my God. Well, they would always give you a glass of your favorite, whatever it was. Mine was scotch. And they would give me a full glass, a tumbler full of scotch, and they would give you cardboard sunglasses. Because you didn't remember sunglasses at 5:30 in the morning. You go, oh, these are like heaven sent. And I would walk out of this place, and I walked out of there one night, had my cardboard sunglasses on, my glasses scotch, a cigarette hanging out of my mouth. Get into my car, and I'm driving away, and next to me pulls up at a light a little family in a little car, a little compact car, and I look over at them, and they're all dressed up. You know where they're going. Sunday morning, you know where they're going. And the kids are dressed up, and the little girl's got curls in her hair, and a little boy. And I'm thinking, God, what a bunch of losers. And I got my sunglasses, and I'm sure they looked over at me and said, look, Dad, the Antichrist. Because of a loving God and the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm in that car today. Thank you.